17th century rabbi, scholar, diplomat, printer, and publisher Manasseh ben Israel has been called the most famous Jew in the world for his time. Yet he died poor and felt he had been a failure. Why is it important today that we know about this world-celebrated rabbi and author? Joining me is Stephen Nadler, William Hay Professor of Philosophy, F.U. Bascom Professor in the Humanities, and Weinstein Bascom Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I'm Emily Auerbach. Professor Steve Nadler's books include Rembrandt's Jews, Spinoza, A Life, and Manasseh ben Israel, Rabbi of Amsterdam, published in 2018 as part of the Jewish Lives series by Yale University Press. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start by asking you why you chose this figure. I mean, when you undertake a biography of someone, you kind of have to enter into their world in a kind of immersion process that probably has an effect on you yourself. And I'm just curious what drew you towards this figure.
Well, it's exactly for that reason. I just am always fascinated with that world of 17th century Amsterdam, and especially 17th century Jewish Amsterdam. And this project kind of fell naturally out of other work I'd been doing on Spinoza and Rembrandt. And Manasseh is one of those great understudied, unsung figures in history who played such a great role and was enormously famous in his time, but seems to have dropped off most people's radar. There's been very little written about in comparison with other figures of the period who have attracted a lot more attention.
I have to say that after finishing your book, I feel kind of ashamed that I didn't know much about him to begin.
You're in good company.
Yeah. But it makes you feel somehow awful to have not known about someone who was so celebrated, who did so much. It kind of makes you wonder why someone dropped out of our consciousness in that way. So first, set the stage. I mean, one of the things that drew me into your book in the beginning chapter was the discussion of his family and the overlap with the Spanish Inquisition. So, you know, first of all, let's get him born, get him his real name, and situate him within the context of his family.
Well, getting him born is not as easy as it sounds because we're not really clear where exactly he was born. Even his own testimony on that is inconsistent depending upon which document you look at. It varies from Lisbon, Portugal, to La Rochelle, France, to the island of Madeira. But I'm pretty convinced that he was born in Lisbon, but the family was suspected of being secret Judaizers. So in Portugal and Spain in the 15th and 16th centuries, you were not allowed to be a Jew. The Jews had been formally expelled from both countries by the mid-16th century. And yet many of these Jews who fled Spain and ended up in Portugal were hounded by the Inquisition because they were suspected of continuing to practice Judaism in secret. And Manasseh ben Israel's father suffered horribly by the Inquisition's torturers. And by the end of the 16th century, the family realized they had to get out of there. And I think what happened was they left Lisbon and ended up either on Madeira or went straight to La Rochelle, France, which, being France, where the Jews were still formally not allowed, France wasn't quite the unified kingdom yet. And so because La Rochelle had a large Huguenot or Protestant population, there was probably a greater degree of tolerance there. I don't think you were allowed to be an openly practicing Jew in La Rochelle, but they probably knew that these conversos, people who had been forced to convert to Catholicism, these conversos or new Christians probably were practicing Jews, but they seem to have enjoyed some degree of tolerance. But eventually, even in France, especially with the French king breathing down their necks, many of these converso families in France fled to other places, Venice, Hamburg, Antwerp, but especially Amsterdam. And so by the beginning of the 17th century, Manasseh's family is well settled in Amsterdam, probably right at the beginning of the I think they arrived there in 1610, and that's not long after the Sephardic Jews, these Jews from Spain and Portugal, finally established a community in Amsterdam at the beginning of that century.
Before we get to the Sephardic Jewish settlement in Amsterdam and so on, back to the father and the Spanish Inquisition, why was he pulled in front of the Spanish Inquisition to begin with? And you know, you write about later how he pretty much never got over the physical
right.
consequences.
He had this is a frequent occurrence. You're denounced before the Inquisition as being a secret Judaizer.
Like sometimes turned in by family members.
Sometimes by family members, sometimes by unscrupulous business rivals who want to get you out of the way. Sometimes by a jealous or envious neighbor. But sometimes by a very close relative, and in this case it was a close family member. Both Manasseh's father and his wife were tortured by the Inquisition. And in this case, the torturers or the Inquisition suspicions were correct. This was a Judaizing family, mm-hmm. Which is probably why they got out of there as soon as he was released. I think the torturing was so damaging to his body that they realized that they couldn't continue with this, so they released him kind of on house arrest or on probation, but he wasn't going to take his chances.
So when they arrive in Amsterdam, what kind of situation do they find themselves in?
They were not well off because they had probably left a good deal of their property, most of their property, back in Portugal or La Rochelle. This was a community of fairly well-off professionals and merchants, and they had set themselves up in Amsterdam, which is a very, very tolerant city for its time. The Jews in Amsterdam were not compelled to wear any special marks or live in any particular part of the city.
And they didn't have to convert.
They certainly did not have to convert. And by 1610 or so, right around the time that Manasseh's family arrived there, there was an open and fairly respectable Jewish community, mostly Sephardic Jews. The Ashkenazic Jews from Eastern Europe didn't start arriving till later. And they were engaged in business and social relations with the Dutch. And, you know, there was a great deal of poverty as well in this community, but there was money there. And they were able to maintain their trade networks across the Atlantic and with Spanish and Portuguese colonies in North Africa and the Caribbean and South America.
So what did the father do to earn money?
We're not so sure. The family had a history of being nail sellers back in Portugal. We don't know what Manasseh's father continued to do once they landed in Amsterdam for a living. And it seems that Manasseh himself was never very well off, so there was not much for him to inherit from his family. They may have enjoyed some charity from the community. They had a very significant charitable organization, the Sephardic Jews in Amsterdam did. And he must have found some way to make ends meet, or at least close to making ends meet.
You write about Manasseh himself that at quite an early age he gets an education and starts showing gifts as a speaker. He writes, "In my youth, I was so devoted to rhetoric and so eloquent in Portuguese that when I was 15 years old, my discourses were very pleasing, applauded, and well-received."
Yeah, Manasseh was not a very humble person.
I was gonna say.
But the Amsterdam Sephardim really very quickly and in a remarkable way established one of the shining jewels of Jewish education in Europe in the period. And there, both the elementary school system and the yeshivot or adult learning academies and the rabbinic training academy were famous throughout Europe, and Jews from all over would send their sons to be educated in Amsterdam.
So is it true then that he became a rabbi by age 18?
That's what he says. he certainly was performing rabbinical functions by the age of 18. He may not have been ordained until a couple of years later, but he was quite young. And part of it was the rabbi who had educated him, Isaac Uziel, had died, and they were in need of a rabbi. And what they could have done, in the early years of this community, because these were conversos who were not learned in Jewish ways, they'd been cut off for generations from Jewish texts and Jewish practices. In order to create a normative Jewish community in Amsterdam, they had to bring in rabbis from elsewhere. So the chief rabbi of the community, Saul Levi Mortara, came from Venice. He was of an Ashkenazic background. There were rabbis brought in from Salonika, from Fez, from Hamburg, and elsewhere. But the next generation, Manasseh's generation, these were young men who had been educated by these other rabbis. And at that point, they decided to go with the homegrown rabbi. And they selected Manasseh, and they selected one of his colleagues, Isaac Abu Abdel de Fonseca. And then the Sephardim were now pretty much growing their own rabbis at this point.
It must have been quite amazing for the father, who had fled from the Inquisition, who was not wealthy, you know, to see his son of a refugee family that's arrived in Amsterdam, rise to prominence that quickly.
Yeah, it must have been truly remarkable, although unfortunately he didn't get to enjoy it for very long because he died soon after that point.
And what about the sort of the world swirling around Manasseh at this point? I mean, you mentioned that it's more tolerant than where he had come from, but it's also a place where there's economic turmoil and religious debates and war.
Amsterdam and the province of Holland and the Republic as a whole, the Republic of the Netherlands, the Dutch Republic, was simply a remarkable place. It was tolerant, more tolerant than anywhere else in Europe, and yet there was a strain of rigid ultra-Orthodox Calvinists who were not happy about having Jews and Lutherans and above all Catholics in their midst. And this was an ongoing tension throughout the 17th century, and the political and religious winds could shift in a very short period of time, and they did at several moments throughout the 17th century. And so one day things are going fine and the more liberal regents are running things. And within a year or so, there's been some kind of political overturning. And now the more Orthodox and the more conservative faction has gained power. So you had to be a little careful. But there was no danger, I think, that the Netherlands was going to make the same mistake that Spain and Portugal did. They realized how important this Jewish community was to their economy. I mean, these were very well-connected, prosperous merchants, and the Dutch were able to take advantage of, for example, the Jewish control of the sugar trade. And you find a lot of sugar refineries run by Dutch, which depended upon successful Jewish merchants bringing sugar over from the Caribbean and from Brazil. So there was no way that the Dutch were going to expel them, but still, the barometer of toleration, it's easy to mischaracterize this as a perfectly tolerant and open environment. It wasn't that, but it was much more tolerant than any other place in Europe at the time.
This is kind of a large question, but if you look at Europe of the time, why was anti-Semitism so pervasive? What were the reasons given when a country decided to ban Jews?
A lot of it was the fear that Jews were out to convert Christians. So, for example, in England, there were always rumors of Jews were there to take over St. Paul's Cathedral and turn it into a synagogue.
And where did those rumors or where did that suspicion come from?
Where all suspicions and conspiracy theories come from, people's imaginations. They were probably fed by either Catholic priests or Reformed pastors or Anglican preachers seeking to monopolize the religious life of the country. And the Jews were a very easy target going way back, centuries, that you need a scapegoat. And the Jews were always a very easy scapegoat because in most of these places, they were not native individuals.
Because they had been kicked out of somewhere else?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also they were vulnerable. And a vulnerable scapegoat is a much easier scapegoat.
Vulnerable why?
Because of their money and their control of certain businesses. If things were not going well economically, you could simply appropriate Jewish, if we're talking about the Sephardic Jews who tended to be fairly well off. The Ashkenazic Jews in Eastern Europe were generally, as they made their way westward, fairly destitute. But that just made them even easier targets. Who was going to defend them? And so anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish legislation, there was very little price to pay for that. And rabble-rousers and demagogues always need someone to step on.
And so let's say that you were a Jew living in Amsterdam in the 1600s, the time that Manasseh is there. What were you able to do and not do in terms of joining organizations, occupying certain professions, living in certain areas, practicing certain professions? How much freedom did you actually have?
So in Amsterdam, you were allowed to live anywhere you wanted, but it was a very crowded city. And the Jews who started arriving there at the end of the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century tended to rent or buy houses in a new part of the city that had been reclaimed from swamps. The Dutch were so good at doing that. But it wasn't a ghetto, and they could live anywhere. And eventually they started moving out of this fairly constricted area, and you find them owning mansions on some of the wealthier boulevards of the city. The community, the Jewish community, had its own organizations for such things as charity, for health care, for education, and they had their own mercantile societies, their own printing houses. At the same time, they mixed quite easily with the Dutch. And so while they couldn't belong to most guilds, there were guild restrictions against Jews, the Dutch did allow the Jews to join guilds that governed activities that were essential for a Jewish life. So, for example, Manasseh ben Israel was not allowed to open a printing shop because Jews were forbidden from opening up retail shops. But Jewish booksellers could join the bookselling guild because it was deemed essential to having a functioning Jewish community. You had to have books.
And that is a place where he became the first Jewish printer in Amsterdam.
The first Jewish printer and the first Hebrew printer in Amsterdam.
And what led him to make that decision? You know, there he is, a young rabbi, starting around 18 or so. What led him from that place to deciding he needed to start a printing company?
He needed money. He needed money, and he saw there was an opportunity. There were Hebrew printers in the Netherlands, and they were based in the university towns like Leiden and Franeker. But they couldn't really keep up with the demand. Most of the clientele for the Gentile Hebrew printers were university faculty and students. But with this growing Jewish community in Amsterdam, they needed their own books. They needed something. You know, the academic presses were printing scholarly works, but the Jews needed prayer books. They needed holiday books. They needed Torah, chumashim, that is, books that contained the Torah. They needed Hebrew Bibles and so on. And so Manasseh saw there's a great opportunity here, and he jumped. And he had a special type made just for him, and it was a very high-quality type. And within a decade, he was the most famous and respected printer of Hebrew works in Europe.
Where did he learn how to do that?
We have no idea. As far as we know, he didn't apprentice with any printer, but we really don't know.
So he was very enterprising then.
Yes.
Somehow or other.
Out of necessity.
I'm wondering what languages, too, that he both spoke, wrote in, published in. I forgot also to have you tell about his name that he was born with prior to taking a Jewish name.
Right. His name was originally Manuel Diaz. And many of the Jews who settled in Amsterdam, when they took Hebrew names, kept their Portuguese or Spanish names as aliases for doing business, especially if they were doing business with Spanish and Portuguese agents. They also often used Dutch aliases.
And for Manasseh, then, would Portuguese have been his first language?
Yeah, the language in the home would have been Portuguese. Spanish would have been the language of high literature, and Manasseh wrote Portuguese and Spanish quite well. He also wrote several of his works, he published several of his works in Latin. There's some debate about how good his Latin was. He can certainly read Latin, we know that, because he accesses and references many works in Latin. But it's more likely that the things he published of his own in Latin, he originally wrote in Spanish or Portuguese and had somebody translate into Latin.
And then living in Amsterdam, how would he have communicated with?
He must have known Dutch.
Okay.
He must have been able to speak Dutch.
And would he have learned Hebrew then when getting educated?
His Hebrew, yep. He wrote, it's interesting, he only wrote two works in Hebrew. One was a treatise on the immortality of the soul. But he also, at one point, the stadtholder of the Netherlands, which was sort of the highest political office, paid a visit to the synagogue in Amsterdam, and Manasseh was delegated to give this welcoming address. It was a great honor, and he gave it in Dutch. And, we think he gave it in Dutch. We have a Dutch text. But again, he may have delivered it in Portuguese and had it translated. But he could certainly read Dutch. He could read Latin, Spanish, Portuguese. He also wrote some things in English because when he was in England, and we'll talk about this later, I suppose, he had to be able to communicate with English politicians.
He sounds like quite a a scholar of languages when you think about it.
He must have been pretty good, yes.
And a child prodigy of sorts.
Yes.
We'll talk more about Manasseh ben Israel when we continue a moment with University of the Year.
Now, as if in total neglect of myself, I am engaged in trade, which is not only difficult and full of trouble, but also costs me a good deal of time that I would otherwise devote to my studies. But what else am I to do? I have neither the wealth of Croesus nor the soul of Thersites.
That's Manasseh ben Israel's complaint in the late 1630s that he needs to engage in trade to supplement his work as a rabbi. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Steve Nadler, and we are talking about this famous 17th century rabbi and scholar, Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel. So we've talked about how he started this printing and publishing company as a way to make money. Is he supporting a family at this time?
He is. So he has his wife, Rachel, and he has two sons and a daughter. The daughter's name was Hester, and the sons were Samuel and Joseph. And eventually he would bring the sons into his printing business. But they were also engaged in the book-selling trade that he had as well.
You've referred several times in your book to the fact that he was one of the most, or was the most famous Jew at that time. Right. And that's kind of hyperbolic.
It is, but you know, I'm open to challenges. But
okay, well, I'm not challenging, but I'm looking at sort of an understanding of that celebrity status. Did it mostly come from his position as a publisher, as a runner of a printing house, or did it come from his own writing and thinking?
It came from both. I mean, he was very well known as the best printer of Hebrew books at the time. And so that brought him a kind of fame. But what I think really polished his reputation was his engagement with Gentile scholars. He became the kind of go-to person for all things Jewish. Gentile scholars from the Netherlands, Germany, France, England, and elsewhere sought his opinion on Judaica. If they had questions about Hebrew Bible, if they had questions about Hebrew language, if they had questions about the Jewish religion, about Jewish law, he basically served as the pan-European consultant on Judaic matters.
You write in your book that you see him as a most tolerant man in some ways, that he was able to listen to Christians and consider their opinion. Is that one reason he got that niche as the go-to person, is that he was seen as someone more open-minded? Or
I think that's part of it, although the other rabbis were fairly cosmopolitan people as well. It's not as if that there was a very insular mindset. Rabbi Morterra, for example, had a very rich library, included non-Jewish philosophical works. So there wasn't this closed-mindedness that you often find in normative Jewish communities in this period. However, Manasseh seemed to be especially good and especially interested in translating Jewish matters for a Gentile audience. The other rabbis wrote mostly in Hebrew or Portuguese, but Manasseh was concerned to make sure that his works got translated into Latin and thus were accessible to a much broader audience. And there have been studies recently by scholars showing how, depending upon who he was writing for, Manasseh would actually tailor what he had to say. And so he was a very good spokesperson for Jewish matters, even though the things he said might not have seemed to other rabbis as perfectly kosher. Manasseh was willing to engage Gentile scholars and help them understand Judaism, but also maybe try to find common ground without going too far. I mean, a lot of these Gentiles who sought him out had conversionist intentions. They were trying to engage Jews for the purpose of converting them to Christianity, because it was believed that when the conversion of the Jews happened, then the second coming of the Messiah would occur. It was only so far Manasseh would go, but he was willing to go fairly far and find common ground. So much as at one point is saying that the core of Judaism and the core of Christianity is basically the same. We worship the same God. We're both expecting the Messiah. It's just that you, the Christians, are a little mistaken about this notion of the second coming.
I noticed that he got into various fights with other rabbis, various competitive moments, disputes.
Yeah.
Is that because his personality was brash, or just, I mean, looking at the different times that he got in trouble with other rabbis, what do you see as the...
I think he was brash, and as much tolerance as he had for Gentiles, he had very little tolerance for the way he was being treated within his own community. He thought he was being disrespected, and he was. He didn't get along well with Rabbi Mortera or Rabbi Abuab, and there was a great deal of rivalry. In fact, with Mortera, there were several incidents over the 1640s and 1650s where we know that they were insulting each other in their sermons, so much so that the directors of the community had to step in and say, knock it off, guys, or you're going to be put under excommunication for a little while. With Rabbi Abuab, there was a great deal of resentment because even though Manasseh was third in rank of the rabbis and Abuab was fourth, Abuab got paid a lot more than Manasseh. Manasseh was only earning about 150 guilders a year, and Abuab was earning over 500. Manasseh was not allowed to give sermons as often as the other rabbis. So he really resented the way he was treated by his own community. And it may be that he was treated that way because they resented how much he mixed in Gentile society. Maybe they were jealous or resentful of this opening that Manasseh had outside of the Jewish community.
What about his writing? Let's take a look at some of the books that he wrote himself and what they offer in the way of new thinking.
Okay. Well, his most famous work at the time was this four-volume treatise, which took him several decades to complete, called The Conciliador, The Conciliator. And his project in this book is to take all of those passages of the Hebrew Bible that seem inconsistent with each other and show how they can be reconciled. So, for example, was a woman created out of man's rib, or were man and woman created at the same time? Because you have the two creation stories. And so by distinguishing between literal readings of passages and figurative readings, Manasseh is trying to show in this work how all of these apparent inconsistencies in the Bible can be reconciled.
And who was his audience for that?
His audience was both Jewish and Christian. The Jews who had settled in Amsterdam, especially in the 1610s and 1620s and 1630s, remember, these were Jews who were fairly new to Judaism because they had lived as conversos, or they were descendants of families that had been conversos in Spain and Portugal. And so their faith and their understanding of Judaism may have been fairly tenuous. And perhaps as they read the Bible and found all these contradictions, there was a danger that they would say, the heck with it. We don't have patience. So it was a way of, I think, appealing to these new Jews or newly returned Jews and helping them make sense of the Hebrew Bible.
Seems like an audacious task if he thinks he can explain inconsistencies all the way through the Bible.
Every single one. Yeah, it's truly audacious. I'd say he was an audacious person.
And so was he working in Hebrew then? Because a lot of it comes down to semantics and, the meaning of certain words and how you take certain phrases, which gets down to which language are you looking at?
Well, the Conciliador was written in Spanish because a lot of these Jews would not have been able to read Hebrew.
But would he have been looking at the Bible in Hebrew?
Yes, he would.
And then
have
translating the discrepancies or the inconsistencies that he was discussing, but translating that into Spanish?
Yes.
That's quite a task.
Yeah. But he was a man, it seems, of enormous energy and ambition. I mean, to have been a rabbi, to have been a teacher, to run this printing press, a book-selling business. He also had a mercantile business. He and his brother were had a importing business, bringing over probably sugar and or tobacco from Brazil. And so, again, he's trying to keep some kind of income going. It must have taken enormous physical and mental energy to keep all these projects going.
And when you look at the Conciliador, this work that's supposed to, I guess, maybe address skeptical people who see that the Bible's not making sense, it's not matching, it's not explaining things right. When you look at it, do you see that what he did is a success? Did he accomplish his mission?
Well, it takes a you know, you have to be looking for success to find it in this case. I mean, there's a great deal of cleverness in reconciling a lot of these passages. You know, coming up with the literal reading of a passage is one thing, but coming up with a figurative or metaphorical reading, which will make these passages consistent, it takes a very clever and creative mind to do that.
Did he find readers who supported him? I mean, was it a New York Times best-selling equivalent of the time?
It was regarded as a major work, but it also had its critics. You know, some of the critics were motivated by anti-Semitism. You know, this is not, a Jew has no right to do this, and why should we believe what a Jew has to say about these things? But like any successful book, it was widely acknowledged, if not widely read. Who knows who read what? But it really created a good deal of fame for Manasseh.
And at this time, would it have had to go through any kind of a censor, or could he put anything into print?
There wasn't a requirement. The Dutch did not require pre-publication approval. They tried to for a while, and it didn't work. Within the community, it was a good idea to get the approval of the Ma'amad, the governing board. And you find in his works letters of approval from the community's directors and from other rabbis.
Hmm. I noticed that another book he wrote was called 30 Problems About Creation.
Yes. That's a
Only 30?
Those are the 30 he decided to pick on. So, for example, how many... on what day did God create souls? And what about demons? And did God create demons? How long did it take God to create light? Really interesting philosophical and theological questions that are raised by both the biblical text and just general topics around creation.
And was the goal the same then, to sort of in his discussion of this to help people be more solid in their beliefs?
Yeah, it's a guide. If the Conciliador is a guide to how to read the Bible and have it make sense, this might be seen as a guide for how a good Jew should think about creation, what to believe and what not to believe.
At this time, in addition to publishing his own works, he's also publishing other people's works. Did he ever make mistakes in terms of who he decided to, publish?
He did. Well, it depends who you ask, which counts as a mistake. But at one point, he published a book called the Sefer Elim, the Book of the Gods, by a man named Joseph Salomon Del Medigo. Del Medigo had studied with Galileo in Italy and eventually ended up briefly as a rabbi in Amsterdam. But this is a very unorthodox book, not least of all because it defended a heliocentric or Copernican theory of the cosmos, which in many circles at this point, well, we know Galileo was punished by the Catholic Church, and so this was regarded by the rabbis of Amsterdam as probably not a wise publishing decision.
Did any consequence come from that? Or?
He got chastised, but no, he wasn't punished for doing so, but... he may have gotten approval. We're not clear where exactly he got approval to punish it. He would often, if he thought that the Amsterdam Jewish community was not going to approve a book, he would often write to rabbis elsewhere to get their approval. So in one case, we know he wrote to Frankfurt to get their approval to publish something. In another case, he wrote to Venice to get their approval. So he was willing to go above the heads of the local rabbis and lay leaders of the community to get something published.
You include as an appendix in your book something about his relationship to Rembrandt and what's myth, what's fact. But where does Rembrandt enter the story here?
So Rembrandt lived for a while up until 1657, lived right in the heart of the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam. And I say the Jewish quarter, again, it wasn't a ghetto. They didn't have to live there, but this is where most of the Jews tended to live. Along the Breestraat, which would later be called the Joden Breestraat, the Jews' Broad Street. But this neighborhood was also the center of Amsterdam's art world. This is where painters and art dealers lived. And Rembrandt was quite familiar with quite a number of the members of the Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jewish communities. What his relationship with Manasseh was is subject to a good deal of speculation and mythology. You could read works on Rembrandt which discuss the close friendship that he had with Manasseh, that they were neighbors, they were soulmates, and so on. I think that goes way beyond anything that can be confirmed. There are two things, though, that suggest some sort of collaboration. One is a painting that Rembrandt did where it's called Belshazzar's Feast from the 1630s. And the Hebrew writing on the wall that puzzled Belshazzar and his wise men appears in this painting in a very particular organization. And there was a great deal of debate among the rabbis as to how the Hebrew, well, it was actually an Aramaic text in Hebrew characters, why Belshazzar and his ministers couldn't read this text. Was it coded in some way? Was it written backwards? Was it upside down? And there was one solution that the rabbis gave, and Manasseh had written a book in which he argued that this was the particular way in which the text, the writing appeared to Belshazzar in the book of Daniel from the Bible. And so when Rembrandt did a painting of this episode from the book of Daniel, we see that Rembrandt adopts exactly the structure of the Aramaic writing that Rembrandt has in his book. In fact, it looks exactly the same, almost as if Rembrandt was looking at Manasseh's book. So it's possible that when Rembrandt wanted to know how he should paint these Hebrew characters in this work on Belshazzar's feast, he consulted with Manasseh.
So either talked to him or actually saw the
book hadn't been published by the time when Rembrandt made the painting, but Manasseh had this solution in mind. Almost certainly, it was just a couple of years. The other instance that might have been a collaboration was Manasseh's book called Pietra Gloriosa, The Glorious Stone. And it's a messianic book by Manasseh in which he argues that there's a rock that makes multiple appearances in the Hebrew Bible. It's the rock that David used to slay Goliath. It's the rock that that Jacob rests his head on when he takes a nap and sees the angels going up and down the ladder. And Manasseh argues throughout this book that this rock has messianic implications and represents, in one episode, the coming of the Messiah. And he wanted there to be illustrations for this book. And in some of the copies of the first edition of Manasseh's book, there are four etchings by Rembrandt. They only appear in those copies of the first edition, and not all the copies. And then in some copies of the second edition, they're replaced by etchings by a Jewish artist. We don't know whether Manasseh and Rembrandt directly collaborated on this, or whether somebody who owned copies of the first edition himself asked Manasseh to make these special plates for his copies and copies for his friends. It seems certainly plausible that there could have been a collaboration. But then if there was, why were Rembrandt's etchings removed from the second edition? So there would be a puzzle about that.
I saw one sketch that was attributed to Rembrandt of Manasseh, but that's apocryphal.
That's not him. No,
And
there's a painting by Govert Flink, who was Rembrandt's student, who also did a portrait that was alleged to be of Manasseh, but that wasn't of Manasseh either. The only authentic image we have of Manasseh was done by a Jewish artist from within the Sephardic community, and it appears as a frontispiece on one of Manasseh's books.
More on Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel, including his trip to England, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I would be appreciative if I might receive from the Most Serene Queen, in one form or another, a commission to purchase some rare items for her, which I may be able to obtain for a favorable price. I petition your grace to recommend me to her most serene majesty. May God protect her with the kindness that you have always shown to me, and I shall always be thankful and indebted to your grace. May the outcomes of your efforts always be favorable according to the wishes of your devoted friend and servant.
It's a letter from Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel to Queen Christina of Sweden. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Steve Nadler, and we're talking about his book, Manasseh ben Israel, Rabbi of Amsterdam. Tell me about that letter to the queen. He's always asking for money, isn't he?
He is. Well, yeah, he was constantly in need of money. In this case, Queen Christina of Sweden was creating a terrific scholarly library in Stockholm. And Manasseh saw this as an opportunity to sell some books. He was selling both books that he had printed and books that he had bought at the Frankfurt Book Fair and elsewhere. And so one of his, he had a catalog of books, and he sent this along to his friend Isaac Vulcius, who was the queen's librarian, hoping to get some patronage from her, both to make a particular sale, but maybe to become her book buyer on retainer. And it became a bit of a mess because the books seemed never to have arrived, and he claims he never got the money. Then... not long after this letter, Queen Christina decides that she'd rather be a Catholic, so she abdicates her throne, converts to Catholicism, and moves to Antwerp, and eventually moves to Rome.
So it didn't help him financially then, it looks like.
It did not. No, in fact, he probably lost money.
It seems sad in a way that if you have a scholar, you know, a linguist, someone that has... you know, it takes the time to write deep philosophical and biblical works, that they're struggling at the same time just to earn a living.
Yeah.
It's pretty tough.
The problem is that, you know, the perfect position for Manasseh would have been to be a university professor, a professor of Judaic studies. But as a Jew, he was not permitted to be a university professor, despite the fact that in the Netherlands, there was a great deal of Hebraic scholarship going on in the universities, and that these scholars were using him as a resource, but there was some talk of finding him something at university, but it never came to anything.
So he's an independent scholar. One of the books that he goes on to write is A Hope of Israel. Tell us about that.
So The Hope of Israel was inspired by the discovery of, or the alleged discovery of, Jews living in South America. An adventurer named Montezinos came to Amsterdam after having spent some time in South America, where he claims to have discovered at least one of the lost tribes of Israel, the tribe descended from Reuben, they claimed. And this set all these messianic minds to thinking, well, all of a sudden these lost tribes are reappearing. And one theory was that the Native Americans, what they call them, the Indians of North America and South America, were the 10 lost tribes. Manasseh didn't accept that, but he did believe that the tribe that Montezinos found was one of the lost tribes. And so the idea that the lost Jews were reappearing, scattered all over the earth, was a sign that the coming of the Messiah was near. And so he wrote a book called The Hope of Israel, in which he speculates both on the stories about the Jews in the New World and other signs that the arrival of the Messiah was imminent.
He seems to have encountered so many famous figures of his time and famous theories, too, including, shortly after that, Oliver Cromwell.
Yes.
Right? Tell us what leads him to take on next the sort of project of England.
So I think at a certain point, Manasseh decided to get out of Amsterdam. Maybe for financial reasons, and set up business in England. But his expressed wish is to go to England because, as he puts it, this is the last place in the world where there are no Jews. And if we can get the Jews scattered to every corner or every angle, that is, every Angleterre, which is French for England, and if we can facilitate the readmission of the Jews to England, that'll bring us one step closer to the Jews being in every corner of the world. The Jews had been banned from England in 1290.
Why?
why are Jews banned from anywhere? Because
I mean, why at that moment in history we don't know.
Oh no,
the
king decided that perhaps the same reason that Ferdinand and Isabella banished the Jews from Spain, seeking confessional uniformity. But there must have been political and economic reasons as well.
So for almost 400 years, we're talking about no Jews?
Yeah.
In England.
In England. Technically. But we know that there were Portuguese conversos in London, and there was a small community of Portuguese merchants in London. Almost certainly they were Judaizing.
And by converso, again, this would be someone who had converted to Christianity under coercion and was living as a Christian, but secretly Jewish.
Yes.
So what makes Manasseh think now is the time to try to change that?
Well, because the discovery of Israelite tribes in the New World suggests that if the arrival of the Messiah is imminent, why not do what we can to satisfy all the conditions that are necessary for the Messiah to come? And this would be the scattering of the Jews to every nation on earth. And if the Jews are missing from England, then we need to do something to get them into England, because that will be... But I think there were also economic and political reasons for him to go. And at one point, Cromwell, I think, was desirous of having the Jews readmitted to England. There had been appeals made to him, perhaps by these Portuguese conversos in London. And so Cromwell, who knew of Manasseh, apparently made a special plea for Manasseh himself to come over and do some lobbying work towards Parliament to get them to admit the Jews. Unfortunately, Parliament wasn't as interested in this as Cromwell was, and things pushed on and on. The Whitehall Conference was inconclusive. And in the end, there was no real resolution. Cromwell was not willing on his own to declare the readmission. He felt that would be too risky a move politically.
Do we know what Manasseh actually did to try to lobby, and whether he spoke well, and was he a good diplomat?
He was. He made the rounds of London society. He met with quite a few influential people, including philosophers in Cambridge and scientists in London. He wrote pamphlets. He was not permitted, at least some of the meetings of the Whitehall Conference, he was not permitted to address the conference himself. But he knew who to speak to. He knew who was who.
You know, if you think about it, they're under kind of difficult situation. If you've got a country that does not allow Jews to live there at all, there he is as a visitor, and he's supposed to make a case why that should change. Does he have to try to attack their prejudices? And, he's defending his people in a certain way. How does he do it?
He does it through effective writing and effective personal lobbying. So, for example, we have this from one of his pamphlets where he appeals to the economic benefits that accrue to any nation that has a vibrant Jewish community. So he knows how to do his lobbying work. Cromwell, too, probably urged him on to make economic appeals as perhaps the most effective.
But he would have seen his work as a failure in terms of succeeding in England.
Yeah, it never happened. And I think the local Portuguese community in London was they were getting a little tired of this Dutch rabbi stirring things up, because once Manasseh made a public deal about this, about readmission, that brought out the worst in English anti-Semites. And so you had pamphlet wars about the Jews and the readmission. And the local Portuguese community probably was nostalgic for those days where they could just manage things quietly. Why make trouble? And I think Manasseh must have regarded his mission as a failure, because after 2 years there was no formal readmission. And then, sadly, his son died in London, his son Samuel. His other son, Joseph, had died on a bookbinding trip to Poland. And now his second son, Samuel, dies in London on this English mission. And Manasseh was just heartbroken.
You write in your book, I think it's the final chapter of the book, that not only is Manasseh heartbroken, but he is broke. He doesn't even have a way to get his son's body back home.
He's devastated by the death of his son. He's depressed by the failure of his mission, and he's destitute. And so in September in 1657, he writes a letter to Cromwell asking for money. "May it please your highness, my only son, being now dead in my house, who before his departure engaged me to accompany his body to Holland, and I, indebted here, I know not which way to turn myself, but under God to your highness for help in this condition, imploring your bowels of compassion, which I know are great and tender, to supply me with £300, and I shall surrender my pension and seal and never trouble or charge your highness any more. I am very sensible considering your great kindness. How highly bold this my petition is, but the necessity of my present exigence and my experience of your admirable graciousness to me have laid me prostrate at your feet, crying, help, most noble prince, for God's sake, your most humble supplicant, Manasseh ben Israel."
You write that that's the last thing we know that he wrote.
It is. It's the last thing we have from his hand. Somehow he scraped together the funds to bring Samuel's body back to the Netherlands. He buried him in Middelburg. They never made it back to Amsterdam, and just a few weeks later, Manasseh himself died.
Leaving behind a destitute widow.
Yep, yeah.
Now, England would readmit Jews shortly after that time, but not in time for him to know that.
Right, right. Yeah. No, he never saw the success of his mission.
As you finished writing the biography that you did of Manasseh ben Israel, what stood out to you the most? Like, what do you think the most important thing about him is?
I think the way in which he was able to open up Judaism to Gentiles, some of whom were sympathetic and some of whom were hostile, and yet able to establish cordial relations. Even the most virulent anti-Semites of the time admired and respected Manasseh as a person. And that's rare for somebody like Pierre Daniel Huet, who would become bishop in France, a virulent anti-Semite. Nonetheless, thought Manasseh was a very fine man. And you don't often see that kind of respect shown to a Jew by a Gentile in this period.
Do you feel he sold out in any way in order to earn the respect of Gentiles, that he toned down certain things or, you know, played his cards in such a way that it explains why he lost the support of some of his own community?
I would say that's true, but I wouldn't call it selling out. I think he was genuinely interested in an ecumenical project of bringing people together and finding common ground and perhaps putting an end both to anti-Jewish sentiment and activity and also maybe healing some of the religious divisions that had so torn apart Europe.
What about the lessons for today? And when we're talking about someone from the 1600s that very few people have heard of or know much about,
right. Why
should we know about him right now?
Well, I think it's an important moment in European history and in Western history that Jewish-Gentile relations are, before this time, it's really hard to speak about Jewish-Gentile relations in any way but the hostility shown towards Jews. And of course, there are highlights. There was the golden age of Spanish Jewry in the Middle Ages. But with the 17th century, we really enter into a modern era of Jewish-Gentile relations. And Manasseh himself bears a good deal of responsibility for enlightening Gentiles to the nature of Judaism and for allowing people to see that Jews can function civilly, economically, socially, and politically in a modern European state.
He also seems a model of courage and perseverance from an early age right to his death.
Yeah.
He just kept striving.
Yeah, you know, one person's perseverance is another person's stubbornness, but I think...
or chutzpah or something.
Yeah, chutzpah. He was a man of chutzpah. That's a good way to put it.
My guest has been Stephen Nadler. His book is called Manasseh ben Israel, Rabbi of Amsterdam. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Year.